Let's talk some Leinster. So, a lot of very happy Leinster fans, happy that you're here with us. And we are here with thanks to HeinekenRugbyClub.com. You can get lots of member-only benefits by signing up there, such as invites to events like these. So, really, so that you can't lie about anything from Leinster, we've brought along two of the eyewitness accounts. That's the that's the situation here. So they're both Leinster legends in their own right. So will you give them a really warm welcome, please? Malcolm O'Kelly, Shane Jennings, everyone. Well, lads, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
Am I right in saying, Shane, you have been over to the Checker residence in Australia?
I have. I've been in the Coogee Bay Road. I was. Michael sent me down to Australia for a holiday for a few weeks to do a pre-season with the Brumbies. So I got off the plane. There was a Holden Commodore waiting for me in Sydney. Drove through Sydney and took about 4 hours to get to Coogee Bay Road, and his mother put me in a bed for a few hours, fed me, and then went down to Canberra. So she was a lovely lady, had that Lebanese food. When I went in, she was cutting her tomatoes and onions at the kitchen table. When I woke up, she was still cutting the same tomatoes and onions. And I got a proper feed and I went on my way, so yeah.
Very good. Mal, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much.
You were there when Michael arrived.
Yeah.
So Mick Dawson said he was a calculated punt. What were your impressions when he arrived?
To be fair, we didn't really know Michael. We knew Noxie, and we thought, geez, Noxie's a genius. So we were all quite excited. But it obviously was Czechs that was the real diamond. I think Leinster at the time we were in a spot of butter, but we were in a time of flux. We had two coaches over a period of a couple of years, and you know, Čeka brought that stability, great leadership, and really, it was an exciting period. Leinster were at a low, but we came, you know, under Czech's tutelage, we came good.
What did you think of Mal? He's a little bit different, isn't he?
Big unit,
yeah.
The first thing I thought was there's lots of lineouts. Number one, he's going to catch them for sure. But big unit. It took me a while to get the lie of the land with all those lads. Like, who was in charge? Who was the sleeping giant? Who was the bookworm? Who was the joker? Who was the...
Who was in charge?
Who, I don't know, to be honest.
It's quite funny. I can remember having a chat with Czech at some stage. We were talking about lineouts, and we moved off lineouts, and Czech says, well, look, I've made a decision who's going to be captain, you know, and there was a lot of lads putting their hands up, including myself. But I obviously didn't tell him. I just wanted him to select me as captain. But he said, I'm going to go with Brian. I went, Brian? Brian O'Mara? And I was like, nah, mate, Tricker. I went, oh, all right, yeah. I didn't get it, you know. Obviously, he was captain of Ireland at the time, and it was the obvious choice. But that's where Leinster was. That's where Leinster was, you know?
Yeah. And you should have been captain. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
How strongly did Mal feature in your thoughts for captain?
Well, mate, I think for a guy who he doesn't know, he must have thought I had ESP, because he said he didn't tell me he wanted to be captain and he expected me to pick him for captain. How strong was Mal?
Tell the truth.
No, I went for Brian. Yeah.
Yeah, I did get captaincy once, Jack.
Yeah, what game was that?
Cardiff away.
Did we win?
We did.
Yes.
There you go.
1 out of 100%.
100%.
We did, yeah. 100%.
At that stage, so you went over...
I think you were.
You went over in 05. So as you discussed, 2000, you're setting up your own business. You're coaching Randwick. This is a big enough step up, I would presume, is it? Mm-hmm. Leinster, European Cup, all that kind of stuff. Were you in over your head? Were you thinking, let's see what happens? What were your thoughts going over?
I didn't really know what to expect, you know.
What did you embellish to get this job?
No. This is the only time I really told the truth. So you get the job. Tom, I'm probably not the person you want, really, and they gave it to me anyway. It was... The last meeting... I better not say anything, because I'm not going to be able to tell you what happened, right? One of these days. But the last meeting... Because I must have come three or four times, you know, to... Because I think... they didn't really want me, but they were interested, you know, so because I didn't have a big name like many of the other coaches who would have been coming here, you know. And it was very interesting. I didn't think I was going to get it, but when I did, I said to myself, well, I better make sure I pay these people back, because obviously they're taking a bit of a punt here. Like, I could see it. I don't think it's disrespectful to be saying that they took calculated pump, because I thought it was too from their part. So I wanted to make sure that I paid them back.
Mm. Shane, what were your impressions of Michael Checker?
My first impressions were he was late. We had arranged to meet in Birmingham Airport. I was in Leicester at the time, and we were saying it was the Novotel or whatever, Holiday Airport. And I was like, he said 7:30 or whatever time it was, and it was 20 to 8, and he was literally sitting around the corner and I was around another corner, so he was probably going, this fucking so-and-so is late, and how dare he stand me up, I've come over from Dublin and he's not here on time. And met him in that airport, and he was saying, would you be interested in coming home, and we had a conversation, and I'd never wanted to go anyway, so for someone to offer me to come home, I was just, oh yeah, I'll think about it, slash, if you have a contract, I'll sign it now, kind of thing.
You didn't say that at the time.
So no, it was brilliant, and obviously, being from Dublin, being from Leinster, I genuinely didn't want to go to Leicester, but it was the best thing I ever did, and I learned a lot, and I'm just watching Leinster when I was in Leicester, like... First of all, I wanted to play them. I hated Leinster. They didn't want me to stay enough, and so I bitter and twisted. Probably still am, Joe, according to you. And I just wanted that opportunity. Came back as an opportunity now to put your mouth to actually see if you can compete. And I just knew the talent was there, so it was great. Great opportunity.
Like, it's mad to think of it now, but that there wasn't even, it seems, a dressing room when you arrived, where the players could all tug out. You were all getting changed out of the back of a car for training every day.
Yeah.
Up until what year? Maybe 08, 09?
No, we weren't.
No, it was the second, so your second year.
We got
year
ourselves organised before that.
Well, what year then?
It was your second year,
Second year, we got ourselves.
Moved with David.
Okay, so 06, 07.
A couple of porter cabins. Yeah. Mal had a nicer car than everybody else, so he could get changed a lot better, you know what I mean, out of the back of his car. But, and then we went up to David Lloyd's.
In fairness though, Chex, the first year we were there in David Lloyd's, the changing room was about the size of a cubicle, and Chex's office was about 10 times that size. So there was like 50 of us in this tiny little one, and Chex had this massive office. The following year, Leo came back. Was that the following year? He said, look, Chex, is there any chance you'd and fair play you did. You moved office, and we took hold of that changing room.
Is that right? Okay.
And we never looked back.
I was getting free tennis lessons next door at David Lloyd, so I was fine. Polish guy was giving me free tennis lessons. He was a good player.
Did the dressing room make a big difference?
100%. 100%. And I mean it in a very positive way. Like, it helped us with building our culture, building socially, without having to go out drinking. You know, you could actually have chats, have fun without the coaches being there. You know, it was good crack. You know, it was a great dressing room.
Yeah.
It was imperative, genuinely. Honestly, it was funny because we didn't have it. I remember coming into Leinster and we were changing out of the boot of our cars and porta cabins, and you change in Old Belvedere Rugby Club at the time, but you were in a car to go back up to the gym. And for a team to gel and bond, it is imperative. And like, I remember that team Check was talking about enjoyment. There was 40 lads in a tiny little dressing room, and the crack we had, like every day there was just characters taking the mick out of each other, and we trained hard, and if someone didn't pull their weight, you'd call them out, and it just gelled us, like it does with every team.
Yeah, it's
and
important.
It's just part and parcel of it. But the fun we had in that small space was just bizarre. Like, we're like a bunch of 16-year-old kids for like 20-odd years.
Yeah, and because when you're in David Lloyd's getting dressed, like, just the punters are there out of the gym as well, and you're next to them. Is that what's going on?
No, we were down the back.
Right, okay. Back,
yeah, away from everybody.
What did you make of the whole setup? What did you make of the playing group that you had? Where were they short?
Well, it was... you've got to remember, you've got to look at everything with perspective, right? So you've got to think about where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So I get here, I didn't know a lot of these lads, like considering I didn't know Beyonce, there was a good chance I wasn't going to know a lot of these lads, right? So...
You knew Mal though, right?
Maybe not. No, mate, I wasn't into watching that much footy, like...
Sorry, can we go back to how you got this job? What happened in that meeting that you can't tell us about?
But, yeah, well, I thought, man, these guys are good. Like, I saw them at training.
Jeez, this Brian O'Driscoll kid's good, isn't he?
Yeah, I thought, these guys are good. Like, they've got some ability. There's a few holes, like, you know, you've got to fill and build in, which is absolutely normal. But there's a lot of, the style of game that I like to play, there was a lot there to work with, you know what I mean? And so, we just had to start building it and building on top of maybe the flaws we did have and keep going and see what happened there.
And can you talk to us about how you did that or what that involved? Because the word culture is often talked about when we talk about you. You know, there's 10-year anniversary now, or we've often done shows where your name comes up, as you might imagine. And it's things like, well, check it, change the culture. That's one of the big lines. Can you talk to us about that from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, the players change the culture. You just set the direction. The players wanted to... Well, you heard what Shane just said there. Like, I didn't ever want to leave. I want to be here. This is where I want to be. And once you realise what you actually want, I think that's where I can help them and say, what do you really want out of this? Like, do you want to hold up the trophy? Do you want to have a team that people in your town and in your province support and will be behind? And do you want to live in that world, or do you just... want to play footy and go home at the end of the day? I think you've got to guide people there, but then they've still got to take it and run with it. Mm. You can't force culture, whatever that is. It's not a real great word for it, because that comes from generations and generations and generations of, you know, a nation's DNA. But they built that amongst themselves from the lead that was given, and very much player driven. Once they just got a bit of direction as to what to do, because you don't know what you don't know. Mm. And if someone gives you a bit of a lead in, then you can take the ball and run with it.
Because you must have been, I'd say all of you were a bit horrified in the 06 semi-final against Munster, and it's a sea of red. Or, you know, there is the phenomenon of the Leinster fan who doesn't seem to identify with the Leinster team and supports Munster. All of that seemed to change, I would say, under your watch. Were you aware of that? Were you conscious of that?
But I understood that that if we were to compete with them, Munster, then we would be close to the... They were one of the best teams around. So if we could compete with them, then we'd be close to the top of the tree as well. Mm. So they're right next door. So set that as a... I'm not very... You know, I think that's pretty logical. Set that as the target. Go and compete with them, not just on the field, but off the field as well, whether it be in how we deal with supporters, youth development, all that type of stuff. And then you'll be pretty close to the top and you'll see where you go from there. Mm.
From the outside, it looked as if it seemed to be the right time, the right coach at the right time, where Drico and a lot of the guys and yourself, Mal, were around for quite a while, pissed off at the idea that they hadn't been winning at Europe. A couple of nuggety guys brought back from Leicester. And I say that with the greatest compliment, Shane, by the way. He's still awkward and nuggety, you know, now. But so suddenly all those groups come in at once. And if a coach lets them, gets out of their way and gives them a kind of, I don't know, whether it's the freedom just to have a go themselves and just to try and live it and believe it. Because I think an awful lot up to that period of time for Munster would have felt that they had won over them. They felt they were in control of those games always. They felt very strong in relation to those games, because these guys, they don't know whether they wanted it enough. And so did it go, did it feel like that, you know, that you you're there, this is the right time? Would it have worked 2 years before? Would it work 2 years after?
It's always about being in the right place at the right time, I think, for coaches and player, the groups, whatever it is, business. It's about understanding, but you've also got to understand what that time, like what is happening at that time. If I put it in the most simplistic form, success will come when you do the things that you don't really want to do all the time. And I think all I did with these guys just guide them into the things they didn't want to do all the time and made them do it initially until then they started to want to do it. And then from there, they just took a life of its own. For example, run up that hill. Well, what was the big hill we used to run up? What was that one?
Killiney
Hill, yeah. It was a big hill, actually. But I think I used to tell them, you've got to run up there and you've got to smile while you're running up there. That's pretty forced, I think. But then, you know, the other day I remember taking the boys, the Wallabies, when they came into training camp, and we went down, because even though the Super Rugby coaches wouldn't have wanted me to, we went to a nice big hill, had a DJ playing at the top, pumping out the tunes, and they were just running up, running down. The Sydney Roosters came down, they ran hills up there with us at the same time. I think that's all they needed was just to say, this is the stuff you don't want to do that you've got to do. And then the rest, they had the ability already, the majority of those guys. And then we added some good players. And then you still need a little bit of luck, which you earn along the way anyway by doing that stuff.
Mal, he has the reputation of being a tough taskmaster. What was he like after defeats? What was he like when things weren't being done the way he wanted them?
Well, we did have a 24-hour rule amongst the players not to approach or antagonise Cheka after we lost. It was, do not approach the wild bear. I can remember one time in Glasgow, we lost to Glasgow away, and it's old school kind of changing rooms, like old ga changing rooms, you know. There was a pitch, there was no stand, no nothing, but we lost this match. It was just a terrible loss, you know. We should never have lost them, but we lost them. Anyway, Chex was going, he was fuming. He wasn't happy at all, let's say. And we were all in the changing room, and Chex was outside, and we could just hear him going absolutely mental at everybody that was close by him. But post 24 hours, Chex always had a plan. He certainly gathered himself. I'm sure he's, as I said, he was raw with us. I'm sure he's sorted all that out now. But he was... But, yeah, it was exciting times, that's for sure.
Well, on the sorting it all out, we have a video of him here in action at halftime. There's no sound with this, unfortunately, but maybe you can tell us what you're thinking. This is from a recent game, so it's halftime. What is the gist of this? You know, to be fair, it's not too bad, but you're still very lively. You're on your feet. You're still intense.
You say you like enjoying yourself, don't you?
Is that like go out and have fun?
I just put the towel over the camera. They tried to bring it in at the start.
Is that right?
Yeah. And we said, no, we wouldn't do it.
Joe, at least that's at half time or at the end of the game. I don't know if it's the same game. I remember we were coming back from Glasgow after that defeat. And it's funny when you look at it, but like I can still remember this and how important it was. We stopped off, we got the bus back from the airport, we're going along the quays, and there was a few lads laughing, and the bus pulls over, and people are like, someone getting off here? And then... just kicks off. Yeah. And I was going, this is brilliant. Because, and everybody, like, we were embarrassed, we were pathetic, and people were having a laugh on the bus. Now, granted, I understand people deal with it in different ways, but we had someone who called us out and said, how dare you behave in this way, and you're wearing a Jersey that you should be proud of. You're from this area. I'm not from this area, and I'm caring more about it. Mm. And he called every single one of us out. And genuine, I can still remember, still exactly remember where the bus was. And after that, I said, you know what, we have a chance now. If actually people take that on our chin and we actually address it and try and improve. So whilst it's jovial seeing that, and that stuff's important. It really is important. And that had to happen with us because we had a cause.
Yeah.
Because like Keith said, Munster had the, like... Yeah. It's obvious. Munster and Leinster didn't like each other. They still don't like each other. That's brilliant. That's really, really good. But it's not nice seeing your biggest rivals get the better of you. And we needed that cause. And Czechs, he's been modest about it. He gave us that cause. And for an outsider to do that, it's pretty powerful.
And how did someone like, so, you know, Mal is a laid-back character when you're trying to get tough on things like timekeeping and doing things by the book. How does that go down?
You can't. Genuinely. But, like, that's the beauty of Mal. And I'm not saying it because he's beside me, because... I'd love to be like that. I remember I was rooming with Rocky before some games and he's asleep like 10 minutes before we have to go down for a meal. I'm there with my book on and that line out and this line out and this, and if we go here, and I can't just relax and chill out. Whereas Mal can take it easy and then he knows how to switch it on. There's nobody better than could switch it on like Malcolm. Don't be fooled by a fella who's just like, oh yeah, what's happening? There's a beauty to it. Genuinely, because when we needed him, we turned it on. And that was difficult for me because I was kind of like, we have to be doing this, we have to be doing that. If you're not doing that, man, it's just like as you mature and as you grow, you appreciate people have different ways and manners in which they can get the best out of themselves and get the best out of each other's. And you have to develop and understand that.
Though Andy Dunn told a story, I don't know if you were there, he turned up in a dressing room and seemed to have had an interesting pre-match meal. Is that... Were you there?
I wasn't there, but I heard about it.
Is this the hot dog story? This is folklore. It's also a complete urban myth. But anyway...
Never let the truth get the way in a good story.
Can I just bring it back a little bit further? My opening meeting with Mal was the night before we played New Zealand in 97, his first test. And I walked in to see him inside in his bedroom. We used to have all the doors were left open. We were staying out in Killiney, and all the rooms were open. He kind of guys would call in the night before, and I went in to give him a bit of a pep talk, and I didn't really know him. And I said, listen, just to tell you what the game is going to be like, it gets really fast. You'll be running one direction. You mightn't, the ball will go the other direction. Don't worry about it. You'll get to a beat to it after a while, and you can ask at any stage, and if there's anything to worry about, I said, have you any questions to ask? He says, you know me, buddy. I don't give a shite. And I didn't know him, and I said, we're playing New Zealand tomorrow, and I've got this Muppet with me. And he went out and he played a stormer the following day, and it took me a long time because I always liked Mal, but my God, he was driving me mad, because you were never he was brilliant on the field.
What is the folklore story that Mal says isn't true for people who haven't heard it, Shane?
So the story goes, before, I don't know what game
it was Edinburgh in the Heineken Cup, and it was in Donnybrook, and I arrived in just as they were handing the jerseys with a big lump of mustard on the side of my face. And it was like, just arrived in just as they were handing my jersey to me. It was like Brendan Mullen was giving my jersey, and I was like, oh, thanks very much. But it was not mustard, but I was. The rest of it was true.
Right, okay. You mentioned Rocky Elson there. If you're talking about 09, it seemed like he was man of the match in almost every game.
He pretty much was.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
13 man of the matches that year.
He was Cheka's special friend that he brought over. The two of them were tight, just like Joe and Johnny through the successful years a few years later, but... There was one great story, like when you talk about the dressing room, like there was such genuine characters and great fun. There was one guy, Stephen Keogh from Limerick, who was playing up in Leinster for a fair few years, and he was behind Rocky as every other six, or if Rocky was playing seven, every other seven would have been behind him. And we were training in Donnybrook that day, and we'd go back up to David Lloyd Riverview where our dressing room was, and there was a few that were up there a bit early, and Czech was back in his office, and word got up that there was a crash in Donnybrook. And it was Rocky. And people were like, really? Jeez, I hope he's okay, blah, blah, blah. And as the word was going around, you see Cheka bolt by the door, out the car park and up the car. And Kyo puts his head out the window and he's like, shh. He goes, don't worry about it. It's only Kevin McLaughlin. So then he goes, oh, fair enough, and turns around and goes back into his office. Now, when I say don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, some of that is true. And Kev, I'm sorry, but that's the kind of Kyo did that. And it probably wasn't a crash. It was a little fender bender as well.
Oh, dear.
The bloke was apologising because, I'm sorry I crashed into Rocky Elsom. I promise I won't do it again. The poor guy in the other car. Rocky, he had the accident. There was a car accident. And everyone's looking for him, thinking he's, you know, where is he? Has he gone to hospital? No one could find him. And then we went back up to the thing. He was in the gym lifting weights.
Wow.
He just left the car in the middle of the road. He's back up in the gym lifting weights. Yeah, this guy's a genius.
Some of your teammates can't be here, but some of them have sent a few messages. So have a look here at the screen.
Jex, this feels a little bit like a cross between This Is Your Life and an obituary. But I certainly don't have any morbid thoughts of your time at Leinster. You know, looking back to the team that you inherited in 05 compared to the one you left behind in 2010, we have so much to be thankful for. A relative unknown coming from Randwick, all I heard was that you were an absolutely filthy player. So, you know, the hard edge that was going to bring anyway, if nothing else, we're going to get a bit tougher.
The abiding memory that I have under my time with Chex was his ridiculously bad nickname that he had for me.
Good evening, everybody. I was lucky enough to join Leinster at the same time as Michael, 2005, and spend 5 years under his watch. World-class coach, unbelievably driven, sense of purpose, resourceful, highly emotionally intelligent, and makes people better on and off the field. We owe him a huge gratitude, anyone who played under him. He certainly turned Leinster around and changed our mindset. From being a little bit soft underneath to having a hard edge and having a winning mentality. Unbelievable coach, and I certainly wish him all the best at the World Cup with Australia.
He used to call me Inkjet. My name being Toner, you put toner into a printer, a printer being Inkjet. It was ridiculously bad, and he called me it every day.
Kia ora from sunny Wairarapa. Checker, he's the man. Firstly, I want to say congratulations to Chex. You know, it's well done on your career so far. You still got a long way to go. I think it's it's a good show in honouring you and what you've done for Leinster, for yourself and your family. You know, Chex has been awesome for me. Me and my family, firstly he brought me to Dublin. You know, I came there on a 1 month medical joker, or 3 month medical joker, and I ended up staying 5 years in Dublin and enjoying myself along the way. And, you know, Chex also took me to France after that. So I owe a lot of my career and my life. Not only for myself, but for my family as well. He gave me a lot. You know, I learnt a lot of him. And I'm sure so did the rest of the boys on and off the field. You know, I was there, you know, when we went, when the tide was just turning. We were turning into a good force. And I owe a lot of that. I'm sure all the rest of the boys do too.
But on a serious note, he was an unbelievable coach to me. It was him and Bruiser first that kind of gave me my first shot. And obviously himself and Jono kind of pushed me on after that. So I'm forever grateful, obviously, to him for giving me that first chance. I think, obviously, well, he thought he saw a little bit of something in me. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for that. And, yeah, I wish him all the best.
I must say, those 5 years were brilliant years. Me personally, I think you were the reason that I stayed in Ireland. and didn't go further afield because it felt as though we had a chance of winning. I didn't think we'd definitely win, but it felt like we had a chance of winning with you as coach and with the mentality change that you brought to the team, with that winning culture that you tried to develop. You broke us to build us back up again. And I think all those seeds that were sown back then, I think Irish rugby is reaping the rewards of them now. Because for me, a successful Leinster equals a successful Ireland. And, you know, we had a lot of fun with that lunatic David Knox that you brought with you for the first couple of years.
You know, I was trying to think of something funny to say about chicks, but well, I couldn't think of anything, you know. You either got an angry chicks or a down-to-earth, straight-up guy, and that's all you need. So from me and my family, to all of you in Dublin, and to chicks, you know, cheers for everything. Thank you. And I'm standing here in my wife's shop with a cord, Churchfields, after the estate we lived in Dublin. So have a good night, enjoy yourselves, and I'll see you in May, and we'll have a scoop there.
It was always enjoyable listening to your team talks. Never did I hear repetition. Never did I get bored of what you were going to say before matches, and that takes a smart person and a well-thought person to, you know, come up with new ways of saying the same thing. And, yeah, you know, only great memories. And you know, from a personal point of view, you know, one of my favourite coaches to hang out with now and catch up with. You know, a great person as well as a great coach. So, yeah, welcome back. I'm really sorry I can't be there tonight. Definitely feels like this is your life now, but have a beer for me.
There we are. Really nice. That's a pretty good testament to you, isn't it? That's just a handful.
Jeepers.
Nice.
I feel like I should go to my own wake now. Where's the wake on it?
I think we've got to get Stan right to a roadshow as well. That's takeaway number
one. You'll need a translator, though. I'll tell you right now.
You can see a glimpse of the bond there and the lads talking, how close you all were. How ballistic, irritated, angry were you when you're working so hard together, you're moving in the right direction, and then you can be dismissed as ladyboys?
Well, I didn't think that. I don't think that type of language in reference to people who go on the field for combat sport is appropriate. Mm. It doesn't matter. Like, it's not a things shouldn't be a personal like that, you know, either. Everyone's doing their best out there. There's no need to personalise it in nature. I don't think the lads cared that much.
Did you? Did it bother you? Did you use it?
No. Yeah, mate, I used it all right. Don't worry.
How did he use it?
How do you use it? Oh, the article was up in the changing room. I mean, the match changing room, not the training changing room. Like, no, he was pointing at it. He was doing that, and he was doing that. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Because that was the image of Leinster that you wanted to change.
Well, that was only his image of Leinster,
sure.
Right? I wouldn't be taking that as gospel just quietly. I think there was a lot of people out there that were supporting the team coming from the first time at Donnybrook. You know, we always tend to focus on the people who want to criticise, but then behind that, there's a massive majority of people who want to get behind their team. You just got to give them something to get behind. Mm. So it's a fine balance between accepting criticism that's warranted, which you must do all the time because it's part of the improvement stages where you've got to accept that criticism and then move on with it, and then also standing up for your rights, you know what I mean? Standing up for the people who are going out there to bat for you and going out to represent you. It's always a balance, and you've got to keep yourself really clear on when's the time to stand up and rage against the machine, you know, or accept the criticism and say, I'm going to get better for knowing that. And I think that when you care, which is the key word here, caring, when you care about it, then those decisions are really easy to make. Mm.
You're about 10 years this weekend from the Harlequins game, the 6-5 game. That must have felt like almost the culmination of everything you were working towards. 6-5, you had such a fight.
Great attacking potential that day. We just were scoring tries for fun, not. The one thing I remember about that game, and we can talk about tactics and all those types of things, the biggest mistake that the Harlequins made that day was to give all our supporters seats together at the stand at the end, because they were making more noise
That, and the whole game was being played up the other end of the field, mind you, because they were attacking our line non-stop. But they made more noise than I've heard an away crowd, mate. Well, you know, for a small group of people, they had that whole back stand at the end and they were just going crazy for the whole 80. I remember the players talked about it extensively afterwards and how that sows the seed of, well, we can't let those people down now. Look what, you know, they probably got us over the line that day. You know, the people in that back stand that were yelling and screaming in that game. So it was just amazing of how the crowd can connect with the team. And often in the teams, we talk about how we can get our crowd connected into the game. What can we do in games to get our crowd connected with us so that they're a very powerful weapon when they're on fire?
Yeah. I'm sure Croke Park is an amazing memory for Ollie as well. There's somebody here saying, I know Shane Jennings told the story the last time he was on about visiting Croke Park before the Munster game. Ask him about it again. Because you'd never seen a GAA pitch at that stage of your life. Is that right?
I played in Croke Park with St. Colin Kills, I'll have you know, at under 11, yeah. Do I have to say this story again?
No, you don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, I hadn't a full appreciation of the history of Croke Park. So that week we were, Jex and the coaching staff had us humming, to be fair, and come Tuesday afternoon, we were ready for the game. We had kind of got a lot of our prep done, and I'm sure Munster was the same. Whenever you're ready for a big, big game, you're just waiting for the game, so you're killing time. And the organisation had come on an awful lot as well, and the marketing department had worked on reaching out to the province and getting the bigger supporter base, and there was flags all around kind of Connolly Station and around the city and then Clonliffe Road throughout the week. So it was building up and building up. So I went down on our day off on the Wednesday and went into Croke Park to get a flavour for the museum and the ground or whatever. But I was kind of, you're kind of in the zone and you've nothing else to do with your life. I wasn't working. I didn't have family. So I was just constantly thinking of the game, and I had Last of the Mohicans on repeat over and over and over. So I was just like, when's the game going to come kind of thing. So I went into the lady at reception. I was like, oh, I'd like to see the museum. She said, oh, great. Yeah. Are you going to come to the game at the weekend? I was like, oh my God. And I just hit the roof. I was like, how dare you? This is exactly what Chex was talking about. None of these people care about us. They don't know who we are. And like, this lady hadn't a clue. She was just doing her job. And I was just like, that bitch. And going around like angry at looking at all the history of it. And like, but I jest and say like everybody had a reason. But genuinely, everybody had a cause. Whether it was the comments that were dropped by journalists, whether it was something that happened a few years previous in Lansdowne Road, and I just had a kind of cause. I said, if we don't win this game, yeah, Leinster Rugby will go back, who knows, for the organisation, for the province, for the supporter base, for the players. It was just, we couldn't lose that game. And I think that was just my individual motivation. I was like, this is our town, this is our team, we got to prove ourselves and we got to be known and we got to get the respect of people. Whereas this lady was just in the wrong place at the wrong time for me. And yeah.
Sexton obviously famously comes on in that game. How much were you holding him back? Like, were you fairly clear in your mind that Contebone was still very much the man? I know Johnny Sexton probably feels should have been thrown in there earlier. Was that a big thing for you at the time, do you remember?
Well, I had to hide personal security, you know what I mean, to travel around with me on a day-to-day basis, because I was worried he was going to gun me down, you know what I mean? Because he'd give me some death stares from the reserves bench sometimes, like, I don't know, just look up and go, okay. And I, you know.
Was he the type who'd knock on your door and say, put me in, come on?
Oh, he wouldn't even bother knocking. He just come straight on in. Really? Yeah, no, come on in, mate, you're right.
And what was your answer back to him?
Oh, mate, it wasn't easy because they're both good players, yeah, you know what I mean? So I just had to go with the flow and see what happened. And it took care of itself in the end, yeah, unfortunately for Filippo. And the fella got his chance. But he'd had a few chances before that in big games too. Like, I gave him a few big games to, you know, cut his teeth on. And,
yeah,
and he was always going to be ready for it when it happened, so.
Did you always see him as ending up almost World Player of the Year territory, and he was going to fulfil all that? Did he have the potential?
I don't know about the awards and all that stuff, but he was definitely going to be a gun player. Right. You know, he was going to be in charge of that team for a long time, both that team and Ireland.
for a long time was pretty clear.
What did it mean to you to win the Heineken Cup with that team?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Like, it was...
Over the top now.
No. I think the essence of, if you want to find the small essence of coaching, is the sort of 30 seconds at the end of the game where if you watch the reaction of the players, I sat back and watched it when it was happening, and you feel you're distant from it because you're off the field. There's a genuine sense of disbelief. And you see that in the reactions, you know, guys jumping up and down and no one around them, you know what I mean? They look like lunatics if they weren't doing it if you didn't have the circumstance and the context. And it's just that little brief moment when you see the people that you're involved with achieve something that they didn't actually think they could do something they didn't think they could do or believe they could do. And then that means they've garnished the belief throughout the time that they've been in with you that they could then go and do that. So, and that lasts for that small period of time until they really realise that they did it. So, winning was, I felt, a return on, I wanted to pay the club back for taking a punt on me. You know, I mean, I was only a small part of that. But it was a good feeling, good for the supporters.
It almost cements the bond, it seems, as well, between you as a group. I know you're all having a 10-year anniversary later on, but it seems to cement all of that work as well in some ways.
Yeah, look, you know, I suppose, winning is a pretty big part of what we're attempting to do here, you know. So no matter what team it is, you want to be a winner. That's why we're playing. And when you do that, it makes the connection even stronger. The connections and the friendships would be there regardless, but the sense of, the shared experience of winning together just takes it to another level.
Yeah. I guess you guys must have really fond memories of that day as well. Any standout ones?
I can remember after the final whistle blew, you know, as you say, you're almost in disbelief, you're running to each other and you're hugging each other, and then I see Shaggy, and obviously I'd been through so much with Shaggy, and we're hugging and we're kissing, and it was like suddenly kind of going like, I don't like this, and then we go running off to someone else, but it was like, I have this picture at home of that moment, not hugging Shaggy, but of the whole team, and you're spraying the champagne and everybody's there except Cheka. But Cheka is, you can actually see Cheka is about 50 yards, right about the halfway line, just looking around and taking everything in, you know, and, you know, like Cheks was our leader. You know, and he was always slightly separated from us, you know. But you knew that he was more passionate than all of us. And he wanted it so much more. And you could just see what it meant to him on his face. He was just taking it all in. It was a wonderful day for us all. And, you know, one of those special ones, you know.
Yeah, well said. Shane, any standout one for you?
Well surmised by Mal, and I played in a final, I think it was 2 years previous or two seasons previous, and lost a Heineken final, and not for my home club, and I've never watched that game. I can't even remember the result. I've tried to erase it from my memory. So the point being, you can get to a final, and when you lose a final, it's probably the wrong thing to say, but you might as well have gone out in the first round, kind of thing. So it was just nice to get to that, and from a, Mal said it better than I could, but like from a collective point of view, the two things I remember through my whole career is after that game, I was quite emotional with my mother because I'd come back to Leinster because of a family situation, my mother, and I was just a bubbling mess. And then the second one was when we won it a few years later, when we actually had to stay after for one of the lads had a urine test, and we just sat in a room, just the team and the squad, and we're just having a beer together. And it's those moments, like we said, where that collective group, the backroom staff, the people that nobody would know here, meant the time and effort that they put into you, whether it's a physio or a rehab guy or a strength and conditioning guy, that's the bond that people probably don't appreciate that we try to articulate, where when you win something, it's just so satisfying and so enjoyable. And the fun you have, like you were talking about, in a tiny little room, taking the mick out of each other 24/7 for weeks on end, running up hills in Killiney. And like, lads are in pain, and the end goal is when you actually achieve something. It's quite a special feeling, and you don't appreciate it when you're playing because you suffer the losses more than you enjoy the wins when you shouldn't. And then when you can actually reflect back and go, do you know what? It's great to be part of something when we actually achieve something. So, they're special days. Yeah, it's incredible.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
We're launching a big competition, which we're pretty excited about. It's to do with Heineken. Adrian Barry has the details. They don't trust me to say this. I'll mess this up.
You will not mess it up, Joe. But we are, in the next few days, everybody, launching a pretty amazing competition to send one person to Rugby World Cup 2019. We're going to whittle our numbers down. There'll be 100 finalists, unlike our two amazing finalists tonight. There'll be 100 finalists who will gather at a Dublin location on the 9th of May. And of those 100 people, Joe, one of them is going to be going to Rugby World Cup 2019 to a game. It's all expenses in. And we're going to have 100 tickets to give away, Joe,
okay,
over the next intervening weeks between now and May the 9th. I have the first screen ticket in my hand tonight.
Oof.
It's Willy Wonka's golden ticket. Roisin's won an amazing prize, obviously, of guaranteed going to the Heineken Cup final, and enjoyed. It'll be amazing. But Brendan, as our runner-up tonight, you're the first recipient of our 100-to-1 chance to go to the World Cup. Congrats.
For your questions, I'm God.
Well done.
Good man. Okay, Brendan. So listen, we're pretty much done. Our thanks to HeinekenRugbyClub.com. Brilliant sponsors. Make this whole evening happen. Thanks to you guys for coming out. We really appreciate it. It's just so much better having all you here. It's a lot more fun. So we don't take it for granted that you come up and pay in and come into the show. We never take that for granted. So it's great that you're all here. I think let's thank our guests one by one. Keith Wood, everyone. The artist, Malcolm O'Kelly. A shout out for Brendan, why not? Roisin stole the show. Shane Jennings, everyone. And a special thank you for a man who's flown in literally from Australia to be here. Thank you so much for being here. Michael Check, everyone. Thank you, Michael. And no, I have not forgotten Stephen Ferris, everyone. Okay, we're done. Thanks, everyone. Good night. Thank you.